This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stachow. Writer Matthew Quick's characters are often a little rough around the edges. For example, his best-selling debut, The Silver Linings Playbook, featured an unstable divorcee and a clinically depressed widow. In his new novel, Matthew tells the story of David Granger, an aging Vietnam veteran who's still grappling with civilian life. His brash personality causes tension with his son and another vet who David wronged decades ago in Vietnam. His book is called The Reason You're Alive. Matthew Quick reads tonight at Quail Ridge Books in Raleigh and tomorrow at Malaprop's Bookstore in Asheville, but first joins me in the studio. Welcome back. Good to have you here.
It's great to be back.
This one, you've done it again, another unreliable narrator, which I think is the toughest thing, and you've done it so well, for any author to do, is to keep us attached to someone who we're constantly asking, should I believe this guy?
Yeah, I mean, I think of it almost like a puzzle, right? You go into the journey, and you think you know this guy, and you turn a few pages, and you think you have him pegged, and then you get a little bit further, and then you realize you don't know this guy at all. And I think that's much like life when we encounter people. You know, we all wear masks, and once we get a little bit deeper, we spend a little more time with people, we start to see, you know, that they take their masks off at some point, and that's what's really fun about working with an unreliable narrator.
So tell us about this one, David Granger.
David Granger is a 68-year-old Vietnam vet, and he, at the end of his life, he has brain surgery, and afterwards he wakes up repeating the name of a soldier whom he had wronged in Vietnam. He's at odds with his extremely liberal son, and David leans right, or you think he leans right. You know, he claims to lean right. And throughout the novel, you discover that David Granger's really hard to pin down and peg, both politically and also as a person. You can't really put him into a box.
And he comes from a military family, so to speak. His father was a veteran, right? And that's part of his consciousness.
Yeah, and I was really interested writing this book and what I'm calling the trickle-down effect of war. Yeah. My grandfather was a World War II vet, and my uncle was a Vietnam vet. That affected radically my father's upbringing, which in turn affected my upbringing as well.
Right, and so being caught in these three generations, and that's what we as readers are brought through. So the depth and the textures here are pretty, it is deep, and the textures are incredible, and they change. Tell us more about some of the unexpected things. I mean, David attends spin class, for instance. And this says, tell us more about that.
Yeah, I'm going to try to do this spoiler-free, but you think you know this guy who has a closet full of guns and loves to wear camouflage, and you think you have him pegged, but he also is a fan of spin class. And you find out he's also a fan of musicals, and he has some rather interesting friends for him. For someone who might seem to be very narrow-minded, he has a very eclectic group of friends. Two of his best friends are a gay couple who he goes to musicals with, and he is friends with, he calls her, his genetically Vietnamese friend with an American heart. Her name is Sue. And these are all surprises to his son, who has kind of written him off. And, you know, that really comes a little bit from my life, too. I grew up I was raised in a very conservative Christian Republican family. And of course, when I went to university, and now that I work in Hollywood and in New York, my needle moved left a long time ago.
But they warned you about that, didn't they?
They did. They did. My grandfather, when I went to college, he said, you need a college degree. He didn't have one. And he said, do whatever you have to do to get your piece of paper. But then he said, I want you to know that they're going to lie to you. And he meant the professors. And he said, I don't want you to believe anything that they tell you. Just get your piece of paper, which was really confusing for me at 18. But, you know, as soon as I got to LaSalle, I was a secondary ed English major. So all of my professors were off the charts liberal. And all of my friends were poets and musicians and writers. And, you know, my needle moved pretty quick to the left. And it put me in a strange position with my family, because I would come home and then comments around the dinner table would rankle and I'd feel uncomfortable because these were men I admired and loved. And likewise, you know, and this happens to this day when I'm around, you know, more people who lean to the left a little bit more, they may make comments about what they might call right-wing nut jobs or whatever, lumping in people like my grandfather or my uncle. And I want to say, hey, like, you don't know these people. You've not spent time with these people. And yes, you're free to disagree politically with what they're saying, but you can't just eradicate them. Right. You can't just say these are non-human beings. And I feel often, you know, caught in between those two worlds because of my upbringing and, you know, where I am now. And the book is very much a response to that feeling of being somewhere in the middle and realizing there's not really a good bridge.
Well, and wanting us to get to know as humans some of these people who you can write off as right-wing nut jobs, right?
Yeah, and, you know, talking, you know, I think it's important to say that the book is not supposed to be nonfiction. It's not supposed to be my uncle. David Granger's a made-up character. The narrative is completely made up. But my uncle was a man who would constantly call me and, you know, say some things that were pretty offensive. He had a lot of offensive names for me. He very much thought of me as, you know, a snowflake or a left, you know, in his mind, I was the most extreme liberal, you know, even though that wasn't the case. But he was also a guy who would call and check up on me in my 20s when I was dealing with anxiety, and I didn't really even know what anxiety was. And he'd say, I spend a lot of time at the VA, and you don't seem right. You know, you're getting out, or you're talking to people. Same stuff he would say to war vets. And I'm not comparing my experience to someone who comes home from war, but if you have anxiety, you suffer anxiety, the symptoms are all the same. And he was a very unlikely ally. Mm. And I think the book is about making unlikely allies. And I think at this time in America, we really need unlikely allies.
Give us a sense of David Granger's voice. Perhaps I could ask you to read a passage and we'll get a deeper sense of who he might have been.
Absolutely. So this is David Granger speaking. It's hard to talk about war with people who haven't seen real action. You don't understand. You will never understand. And so I can't tell you everything, but if you listen the right way, you might just learn a thing or two anyway. My father served in World War II under Patton, stormed Normandy. When I was little, I used to ask him about his war experience, hoping for epic stories full of gunfire, tanks, and Nazi killing glory. When I was a kid, he only ever told me two tales. Neither had anything to do with death or violence. The first was about stumbling onto an abandoned champagne warehouse outside of Paris after Europe had been liberated. He and his buddies were given an hour to drink their fill, and so they did, spraying each other with endless bottles of France's finest bubbles, more than the average American could buy with an entire year's salary. The second story my father told me was about his being run over by a U.S. Jeep in the middle of the night. He was too tired to dig his foxhole deep enough, and consequently, a Jeep ran over his leg while he was sleeping, fracturing his shin bone. He was sent to Paris to recover. According to the story, he would sneak out of the hospital at night on crutches, find the nearest bar, and try to pass himself off as a famous American singer, not yet big in Europe, the next Frank Sinatra, or something like that. After the war ends, you'll be hearing my name everywhere, he lied. The French enjoyed his singing so much, a local artist painted my father's likeness onto the wall of a big Parisian club, or so the legend goes.
Matthew Quick reading from his new novel, The Reason You're Still Alive. Going to read tonight at Quail Ridge Books in Raleigh and then tomorrow at Malaprop's Bookstore in Asheville. It seems to me that this book very much is about sort of the narrative and who we are. I mean, identity and narrative and how they play against each other and how dynamic they are. Mm. The story changes, the reception of the story changes, the individual, and of course you as the listener get a different version every time you hear it, right?
I think so, you know, very much so. And you know, there's a certain dichotomy at play, too. You know, I'd mentioned before about David, and also this was the case. My uncle was a Vietnam vet. How do you make that go together? I mentioned before, like, there's somebody who would insult me all the time. You know, his nice name for me was Sweetheart. That was on a good day if he was happy. But also this man who showed incredible concern. You know, how do you put those two things together? And the answer, I think, is you decide that the person's a human being. You know, we're complex people. And I think we often, as a culture today, we want to say, if you say this, then that means that about you. And we want to shame people for having the beliefs that they have instead of asking, where did these beliefs come from? And why are these human beings ticking the way that they do? And getting to the truth of that.
But also, at the same time, once you take that path that you're on and say, look, could we understand this more complexly? Aren't you almost obligated not to sum it up then? Then I can't sum up this person, this individual, in a simple way. I've got to allow those parallel streams to be who they are.
Yeah, I think absolutely. You know, it was one of those things that I discovered a long time ago with my uncle and my grandfather, that if I was going to have a relationship with them, we were not going to agree on politics. But that didn't mean that I didn't want to spend any more time with them. or that they didn't have information for me that was really valuable. My Vietnam vet uncle didn't read novels besides Tim O'Brien. It was pretty much the only novel we ever talked about, the things they carry. But he became a really unlikely ally in advising me when I left teaching to become a novelist. He was one of the few people who didn't say it was a ridiculous plan. And I remember he played the stock market and he would say risk and reward. If you want a big reward, you got to take a big risk. And then he started talking to me about what my house was worth and laying out a financial plan. And, you know, again, it's all about those unlikely allies.
And how you take it. And it seems to me that your relationship with your uncle and grandfather is the relationship that we as readers have to somehow embrace when we're reading the unreliable narrator. In other words, to what extent am I going to take this guy's advice? I really hate what he just said about, you know, about politics. On the other hand, you know, he's talking to me deeply. And so there, you know, his advice is meaningful to me. And I think that's what we as readers have to do. It's like, what am I going to do about this story that I'm reading by a guy who's, by now, I'm a little bit worried about his stability.
Right? Yeah, and one of the best responses that keeps coming up to the book is people will tell me, you know, I read the first five pages and I didn't know if I was going to make it through. I didn't know if I liked the guy. And by the end, I really fell in love with David and I was crying. And, you know, I really understood where he was coming from. And not that I agree with him politically, but I'm so glad I hung in there and got to know him as a human being. And, you know, as a writer, that's the greatest compliment. But also, I think, you know, it's also moving somebody's needle a little bit more towards empathy. And when I taught literature to young people, I said, that's why we read novels, to learn how to be more empathetic, to realize that, you know, when you meet someone on page one, you know, literally on the page or metaphorically in life, we make these assumptions. And that's because we want to protect ourselves and we want to herd up and we want to form a tribe. But when we break through those assumptions, some really beautiful and amazing things can happen. And, you know, again, not to get political, but I think it's just so timely. We live in a time when people aren't talking to each other about politics. And I think we need to do that. We need to sit down with people we're uncomfortable with and break through that barrier.
Well, because it expands not only who you think they are, but who you have become. Now your scope is so much deeper that you can actually accept a person on multiple levels. And you were stuck with just one way of evaluating everybody. That narrowed who you were.
Exactly. And, you know, David's son, Henri, in the book is extremely liberal, but I would say he's very narrow-minded. And when he meets some of his father's friends that he meets in spin class or when he likes to go to the musicals, he realizes that his dad's hanging out with some of these people that are more liberal than he is. But the difference is that they're more tolerant than he is.
Well, I'm going to ask you about this because this has also been optioned for a screenplay, as certainly was your first book, The Silver Linings Playbook. But you're doing the screenplay on this.
Yes, I am. Yeah, I'm writing the screenplay.
What's that like now? Because you're having to convert this book, which was written as a novel, to a screenplay, and you're responsible for that.
It's a very different experience. I remember speaking with David O. Russell for the first time when he wrote the screenplay for Silver Linings Playbook, and he said to me, and Harvey Weinstein said this to me as well, you're really hard to adapt. You're really hard to adapt. And I had no idea what that meant at the time until someone said, hey, adapt your own work. And I sat down and tried to do it. And when you write from the first person point of view, and especially when you're working with unreliable narrators in a novel, you're just squarely, in this case, in David's head. You're only seeing things from David's point of view. So when you get a depiction of his son, it's not a true depiction. It's how David sees his son. So when you convert that onto the screen, obviously you have two characters playing out a scene. You've got to make that son a fully developed human being, you know, not just from David's point of view, but from the audience's point of view. So it is really tricky, and I understand what Harvey and David O. were talking about now.
Is it difficult for you? I mean, because obviously when it gets to film, and I've talked to a number of writers who say, look, once my book is optioned, I let them take it. I've written my book, and that was true to my vision. And the Hollywood version of it is really their business. Can you let go like that, especially if you're the screenwriter? Because you're dealing with a lot more people down the line. A lot more people are going to check that screenplay than...
Yeah, and I think that's just it. You know, this book is highly personal to me, as all of my books are. And, you know, I made a decision a long time ago that the most important thing to be in Hollywood is professional and to be realistic. And, you know, there are a lot of people that would go to Hollywood and, you know, think that it's all about them. When you ask someone to invest $25 million into a movie, you got to realize that a lot of people are going to have opinions on that, and you're working together as a team. when I sit down to write a novel, it's just me. It's my world. And, you know, maybe this is ego, but, you know, obviously you prefer that. You like to be able to make all of the decisions. And, you know, when you read a Matthew Quick novel, I think you're getting a true experience of who Matthew Quick is and what I have to offer to the world. You know, when I work with other people in Hollywood, you're getting, you know, silver linings. You're getting David O. Russell's point of view. You're getting Harvey Weinstein's point of view. You're getting a lot of people that are working on something. And that's not good or bad. It's just a very different experience. And being realistic about that, I think, is the key.
But so, and you can do that. In other words, this is a book. It's gonna look very different on the screen, most likely, than it did as a novel. And do you see it as a completely different work? Obviously, this is collaborative. Can you let go of it like that?
You know, I like to see it as a companion piece. You know, and so there are so many people that have come to me and say, you know, I love the Silver Linings Playbook, the novel, and I was so angry that they changed it. And it's flattering. You know, you love that. But, you know, I always say, you know, the book is the same. You can go back and read it a million times, and you don't have to watch the movie if you don't want to. But I think it's also nice to have the different companion pieces as well.
Great stuff. Matthew, always a pleasure to have you on the show.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Thank you so much.
Matthew Quick's newest book is called The Reason You're Alive. Going to read tonight at Quail Ridge Books in Raleigh, tomorrow at Malaprop's Bookstore in Asheville, and you can find out more at our website, stateofthings.org. Our program is produced by Anita Rao, Charlie Shelton Orman, Laura Pelliser, and Jennifer Brooklyn. Robin Copley's our technical director. North Carolina Public Radio is a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.